Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. This is your host, Adam Lowry. As usual, you know it, Steve. Sorry, I said it again. As usual, it's what I do. But I am thrilled. No long intro this time. I'm going to contain my tangentialness. I made that word up. For this guest, because honestly, he doesn't know it, but I'll say it now. I've been like a little kid, man. I've been reaching out to Dr. Andrew Hill for a few months now. And lo and behold, to my surprise, when I reached out, I'm all nervous too. And I was calling like, all right, I got to get this guy on. I think we see a lot of things the same way, except he's well more degreed than myself. But anyway, and I was surprised. He said hello. And I was like, me at a loss for words. And Doc, welcome to the show, Dr. Andrew Hill. I would give you a long intro, man, but if you would, just kind of preface everybody with you.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Adam. So again, I'm Andrew Hill. I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, which means I work in the area sort of at the intersection of mind and brain, or largely how the brain produces our experience of mind, and I focus on things involved with performance, and including things that get in the way of performance, like addiction, sleep issues, anxiety, as well as other diagnoses and brain problems like traumatic head injuries, seizures, migraines, ADHD, all sorts of things. So I'm a brain scientist, but also a biohacker, and I tend to work across different challenges individuals have in their brains, be it alcohol or some other sort of behavioral, intervention that isn't going great for folks, or, more sort of advanced interventions. I work in the area of biofeedback on the brain. I have a neurofeedback practice in Los Angeles, and also used to work in an addiction center. I helped found an addiction center here in LA that does moderation-focused approaches to alcohol consumption. And also teach at UCLA courses in neuroscience and gerontology. Usually I've just finished a big gerontology sequence at UCLA this week. So,
oh, okay. All in a few breaths, man. That's why I don't like doing the intros. And a lot of times what you read online too isn't updated sometimes. So and sure. You're also going to mention the things you're really involved with now, and what you're into. And I find it funny too, because I'm looking to pursue a doctorate degree potentially. Great. Kind of came up new for me over the last couple of days.
Maybe.
And I kind of went back and forth with it. And, in my book, I kind of approach a lot of the psychological ways dealing with addiction, et cetera, things that get in your way. But again, yeah. I think addiction is just a symptom really, to a point. But, for you, I like the idea. I think the new frontier is the brain. I think that's where the next answers really lie. That's where the functioning comes down to. But I think we're so still very little in it that right now there's still a lot of focus on that psychological, environmental influence, et cetera.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the brain, of course, has been around for a while, and we've had them as long as we've, been thinking creatures. But we still don't really understand what's going on in this 3-pound, blob of jelly above our shoulders. The more you find out, the more complicated it gets. There's more cells in the brain than there are stars visible in the sky. It is the most complicated machine that we've ever come across. And every time we discover something new about it, it just gets more complicated. So, if you're interested in a PhD, neuroscience can certainly take you pretty far. You can never exhaust new things to learn in a PhD. So.
And well, I'm just going to be frank. A lot of the reason I also dig the psychology side and why I went this route is because in truth, there's technically no right answer, that everything is so theoretically based that if you can base it in the science and you understand what has been proven, then the theories can almost become infinite on how you try to process those together. So I think, maybe if the brain, neuroscience provides that for me, this new frontier to where you can just propose things and study them. I don't know. You may have just.
Yeah. You sort of end up, that is true. I mean, if so little is known broadly that you can often find new information and new theories by digging deep into an area of, brain function. Unfortunately, that often ends up with neuroscientists in what's called a blind men and elephant situation, where everyone is sort of looking at their piece of thing really closely and doesn't have the overall perspective. I mean, the joke about a PhD is it's the art of learning more and more about less and less until you know everything about nothing. And so it's really useful to become a scientist and have this big, broad perspective. but sort of advanced brain scientists or advanced PhDs in any field often have such a narrow, you know, perspective on what they're studying that it's often difficult to get, you know, the broader picture.
I'm glad you said that, actually, because a lot of the cognitive rampage has multiple definitions to be applied. But for me, sometimes when I get into this part is what I found in my field also is those horse blinders of division between behavioral psychologists, structural psychologists, cognitive psychologists.
Yep.
And I couldn't stand it. And so what this book was kind of also a rampage against all of those studies going, hello, don't you know it's you and you and you? And that's where... Well, that's where my theory came from, which was transrational structure behavior theory.
Okay.
And for me, it's kind of going, God, can we stop just saying it's cognitive? Can we stop just saying it's behavioral? Can we, you know, can we merge that together? And that's kind of what a lot of your work does.
Yeah, yeah. I sort of, from my perspective, I don't view any distinction between brain and mind. You know, I'm sort of a reductionist, where the brain is produces the mind. You know, the mind is the part of the brain that we experience directly. But from my perspective, it's all able to be explained by looking at brain activity, brain function. But you're right. We still don't really understand the broad picture. And if you look at three different scientists in three different fields, you're absolutely right. They all have a piece of what's going on, and they could all benefit from, you know, collaborating across different perspectives. You know, Maslow said to a man with a hammer, every problem is a nail. And to a cognitive psychologist, the nail is drawing circles and arrows on the board and saying black box this and input output that and Bayesian this. But to a, you know, EEG neuroscientist, the nail is ERPs or quantitative EEG or looking at the sort of physiology markers. I would say as we, you know, accelerate our understanding of neuroscience over the past, you know, 10 or 20 years, science itself is changing. You know, 50 years ago, you could really develop a huge knowledge base and a huge specialty area working alone by yourself in a room. Nowadays, with all the different skill sets required to do good science, you find that you end up with a big team of people, you know, a neuroscientist, a computational person, a psychologist, you know, maybe a cellular bench, you know, organic chemistry person. And you kind of have to bring together all these disparate fields to make any real significant movement in terms of pushing the needle, moving the needle in knowledge base in a way that has relevance beyond your narrow area. And that's, I think, the challenge of academics, you know, the ivory tower where we're sort of isolated. We don't have a sense of what's real, or we don't have a sense of what is actually happening in the clinical world. I think that's the challenge for academics, is to take the narrow perspective, the expertise that we have in a very specific area, and pull back and find ways to integrate it into, you know, the sort of reality of what is being done in the clinical world, what else is being done in other fields in the research world. That's all difficult. You know, again, science itself is changing, so we have more interconnections between adjacent fields of study, and that's good. But I still think there's a disconnect between, you know, stuff happening in the ivory tower, in the research lab, in the classroom, and in the clinic, you know, bringing things operationally down to the individual to help them change their mind, change their brain. So I think that's the challenge in brain science these days.
Yeah, you speak to belief and the idea of helping change the belief.
I got a slight delay, I think.
Give me a second.
Maybe not.
Sounds fine from here.
Oh, all right. All right.
I do a lot of time to talk to myself.
Before we go further, man, I like to kind of build up the person too. And
sure.
You know, where did you come from? What were you raised in? How did it go down? And kind of walk me through that, of what led you to the neuroscience. Because I think there's another side to you that I haven't heard in a lot of interviews. I hear briefly, and it has to do with a lot of the tattoos I know you have underneath that. A lot of the spiritual experiences that are you know, kind of brushed over in an interview. So for me, I think a lot of that is linked into I don't know, where we're born in, what we come from, and how we develop. So I kind of like to go there, if that's all right.
Sure, yeah, no problem. So I grew up in the East Coast in New England, really rural, you know, sort of isolated towns. I grew up in a town called Westport, Mass., born in Maine. And in both Maine and Massachusetts, the towns I was growing up in were very rural. I mean, in Massachusetts, the town I grew up in had more cows than people, you know. No malls, no industry. And that's good in some ways to keep a kid sheltered and, you know, thriving, but it's not great from the point of view of the kid, you know, really boring growing up a little bit. And, you know, I grew up before the internet and before cable TV to some extent. So information was something I really wanted. I really wanted to drink in. And intellectually, I just absorbed everything I could. To some, you know, somewhat unsatisfied with what I could learn. And eventually, as sort of a young, you know, young man, I found a spiritual community in the East Coast, which has a pretty, let's say, ecstatic focus. Some people may be more familiar with the word shamanic, but that word's got a lot of baggage attached to it. So I like the word ecstatic. If you look back at the definition of shamanism, one of the classic thinkers in this field, Mercedes Eliade, describes that shamanism is essentially seeking altered consciousness so that when you come back to this ordinary reality, you have different insight. I'm sort of sidestepping any discussion of what might be real or not real. Just the techniques are pushing your mind so far that something shifts and you come back to your grounded state with a different perspective. That's sort of the core of shamanism or ecstatic work. And a lot of the work I did for about 20 years was just that, was pushing myself. You know, I have this community of people on the East Coast mostly. Actually, they're all over the country and all over the world now. But, you know, there's a few hundred of my closest friends that I get together with a couple times a year. We find a mountaintop, you know, light a fire from dusk till dawn and, you know, push all night long. You know, dance without stopping, drum. And eventually you fall over with exhaustion, at least your cognitive self does. And you have breakthrough experiences in insight, awareness, dropping stress away. And so for me, this has been a long, you know, lifelong process of going to a place where I can access what Mercedes Eliade would consider extraordinary consciousness or extraordinary reality. And then just breaking the frame, you know, getting out of the 9-to-5 job, the stressors, the bills, the car leaking oil, whatever it is, all the things that impinge upon our cognition and add a certain amount of fatigue and a certain amount of bandwidth saturation, you know, going to a mountaintop and dancing around a fire from dusk till dawn, so much so that your body's exhausted and your mind is altered, you know, really does reset a lot of stressors and momentum. I'm a proponent of examining where your life has momentum and determining if that's actually what you want. I mean, I think we all tend to react more than we act. We tend to fall into a rut or a momentum when it'd be better to simply choose and have some intention about what we're doing day to day and how we're choosing and picking our activities. And out of this, you know, I certainly have a focus as a neuroscientist, but a lot of these practices that I've engaged in over the past, you know, 25 or whatever years have pushed my perspective differently. I mean, getting tattooed for many hours straight changes your perspective after the endorphins have come and gone and after, you know, you're no longer in the first sort of, oh my God, I'm getting a tattoo kind of mode. You know, 6 hours in, you know, that buzz of the needle and the sort of smell of the ink and all the things that when your mind is just completely exhausted and almost challenged by the experience of pain. Let me say one thing about pain, and because this has some relevance for altered consciousness. You know, I don't know if you have any tattoos, Adam, but you find that when people receive them, there's one of two types of people. There's those who are resisting, going, ah, the whole time, which actually makes it hurt more. And those that sort of let the experience wash over them and don't attach to it, don't resist it. And they actually have, I would say, less physical pain, less awareness of that.
I think you just described the two ways that we can choose to see life.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that extends to all kinds of things, right? So in mindfulness or in meditation, classic Buddhist meditation, this idea of attachment or, you know, wanting something or resisting something is, of course, the root of all suffering in the words of this guy, Sid, who came up with, you know, these ideas about the Four Noble Truths. Suffering happens or, you know, shit happens but also shift happens. And it's important to embrace the shift and to know that shift is going to happen whether or not you want it to. And you have an opportunity to, you know, steer the directions of your experiences a little bit because they're going to change. You can't hold still. You can't, you know, stay perfectly blissed out or perfectly suffering free for more than a moment, right? So in all these experiences I've had exploring my own mind and my own world, that has come through a lot, that we have some ability to change. We have the ability to change our consciousness, our mind, our suffering, our mood. And that has really led and informed the science. So a lot of the neuroscience I do is about human potential and changing our brains. A lot of the psychology I do has a focus on things like mindfulness and meditation and ways of restructuring our mind and our brain with, you know, exercises we can do. So it started off in a pretty spiritual, you know, maybe a woo-woo sort of area 25 years ago, but it's all ended up being pretty grounded in the science for me, you know, day to day, ultimately.
No woo-woo here, my friend.
All right.
I got to back you up. And when was your shift?
You know, it's hard to say. I guess 25 years ago, I would go and spend a week, you know, doing this profound work on a mountaintop, and would come back down and spend a week or two in this sort of altered, blissed out, you know, no stress state. And gradually the rut, the habits of life would creep back in, and I'd be the same miserable, you know, lump that I was before. And over many years doing this again and again and again, I would start to get sort of a shift in my perspective. And after maybe 5 years of that, I would, you know, go up to the mountain already sort of in the state I wanted to be and leave in that same state. And there was no longer a, here's me in my spiritual mode and here's me in my, you know, stressed out work mode. The two sort of, you know, combined over time. And now when I go and do, and I still do this work, I mean, in 3 weeks, I'm going to upstate New York to spend a week on a mountaintop and do some ecstatic work. I will enter that environment without much shift, and I'll be able to sort of do that work and leave that environment without profound. I mean, the big issue with ecstatic work for many people is it's not sustainable. You know, you can't sort of go and do a sun gazing thing every week. You know, the Native American hanging on a tree, staring at the sun. That doesn't work as a lifestyle intervention. You can't trip balls on ecstasy or LSD every single week, right, and have yourself be a functional individual. And so finding ways to alter consciousness or get additional insight that is integratable, to make up a word, into your life, I think is really important. And for me, that just happened through practice, through just doing it again and again. And after several years of being in this community as a sort of, you know, ecstatic person who focused on dance, pushing my body, I shifted to drumming, to doing rhythm work. I actually injured my feet at an event. I was there for about 11 days, about 20 years ago. And the very first day of an event, I managed to tear both of the plantar fascia, the sort of arch of my feet. And so I was hobbling around this 11-day event or something without any ability to dance. And I had done a little bit of, you know, drumming. This is a very music-focused, you know, practice. I learned a little bit of drumming before that, but never had the patience or the sort of stamina to sit there and support the dancers in that way. Mm-hmm. And drummers are often not doing ecstatic work. They're often not trancing out. They're sort of grounding their consciousness to provide a safe container for the dancers to then go pretty far. So it was actually an injury that made me sort of sit on the benches and practice drumming all night long instead of throwing my body around a fire at high velocity, you know, and coming back to earth, you know, in the morning. And for me, that moving to more of a service role and a, you know, container building role in this community was a big part of what sort of to cement some of these gains, not going for the profound ecstatic shifts, but just holding that, you know, that space and that awareness of other people's work, if you will, and providing the rhythmic structure. And I also think that rhythm training shifts brain activity as well. There's plenty of research evidence showing that if you engage in rhythm training, meaning drumming or even some simple things that are not quite as you know, cultural, there's in autism work, there's a rhythm training practice called interactive metronome that seems to improve cross-modal integration and some other functions in autism. For non-impaired individuals, there's a very profound rhythm training program called Takatina, which repatterns rhythm perception for people, be it people who have challenges or musicians. Takatina is sort of like patting your stomach and rubbing your head on steroids. You know, speak one rhythm into your mouth, clap a different rhythm, step in a third rhythm, while people are facilitating building up and adding new rhythmic signatures to what you're doing. And so, you know, I can't just suddenly play four different rhythms with my body by stepping and speaking. But in a Takatina workshop, you know, gradually you find yourself, you get out of your cognitive way, and you find yourself suddenly doing polyrhythm in a very complicated way because of the facilitators helping you, you know, bring that piece in. And so, excuse me, for me, Rhythm training has been a big part of this ultimately as a non-cognitive, you know, getting you out of your head, so to speak, and into, you know, body patterning and learning the sort of deep integrated stuff. And I think that we've been banging on things rhythmically since probably before we had language. You know, it's a very deep, innate thing that seems to be there in brains. Humans can dance, even little baby humans that don't have any language, or profoundly impaired humans without language. We have this ability to dance, to move our bodies in response to music. Most animals don't, you know, only I think parrots or a couple other animals can dance to music. It's a very unique human thing. It seems to be akin to language, you know, or the way we process music. And so I think there are games to be had with engaging in these non-verbal, non-voluntary, if you will, ways of patterning our minds. And so even though, you know, I lecture on very discrete topics in neuroscience, a lot of my perspective on this stuff has been informed by, let's say, the non-linear science, the experiences and looking at sort of cultural excursions into what we do with our minds. And this is, you know, this is science, but some of the science is primitive. I mean, when you sit around and do a 6-8 polyrhythm and make a dancer have an ecstatic experience and flop around and, you know, come back with new insight, that is a technique that's been done for, you know, at least 5 or 10,000 years. And yet it's still tapping into altered consciousness states that we're just now starting to get a handle on in the neurosciences. So I think that a lot of what neuroscience is ultimately doing is validating sort of, you know, ancient cultural practices that have a spiritual focus to some extent, be it meditation or, you know, rhythmic ecstatic work or whatever it is. A lot of these classic techniques we're finding now have a really serious basis in the actual science. So,
well, you even see in nutrition, we're going back, imagine that, to eating natural foods that naturally exist that are better for us. And you're right, you see an entire holistic turn. I understand a lot of what you're talking about the drum. I am Native American.
Okay.
And I have sat at a few drum circles of being invited and was allowed to drum for a few hours straight.
Yep.
And hold and build the beat for the dancers and chanters. I even chant. I play the Native American flute. Myself, that's really the instrument of choice. But so, you know, I, even in my book, I talk about a primal activity. And for me, I grew up in the woods. I grew up in the water mainly. My native name is Swimming Bear. And, you know, I was spearing fish and grabbing lobster at like 7. And I've always been at home there. And yep. I encourage people, you know, to find that primal activity. It could be as primal as just walking down the beach, you know, or as primal as, like, I love what you're doing. One, I want to go and dance around and lose yourself in the nature and the primal and the motion. And I mean, gosh, like, yes, for me, yes. We go back to these things of how we naturally move, how we naturally be. Mm-hmm. And the mindfulness to me is simply just returning back to the idea of being.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of it. And mindfulness, or more classically meditation, I tend to draw people's attention to this perspective that mindfulness is just attention training, executive function training. You know, 5,000 years ago, when you know, ascetics were sitting under trees meditating, they were practicing anchoring their attention in a specific way. Nowadays, in like a modern, you know, mindfulness-based stress reduction class, you're doing the exact same thing. It doesn't really matter what the sort of spiritual component is. This is all using your mind, using your brain in a way that is tapping into innate resources and innate abilities our brain and minds have to change. Another thing about this ecstatic community is it is about the community. I mean, if you look at classic Buddhist techniques or Buddhist lessons, Theravada Buddhism, classic sort of first Buddhism, would say that the three gems of Buddhism would be the Buddha, the Sangha, and the Dharma. The Buddha being the example of this guy who suffered and then meditated and got different. The Dharma meaning reality, you know, don't fight against reality. There is a way things are. If you are congruent with it, you will suffer less. And the third is the Sangha, or the community, you know, and the idea is you take refuge in these three things. You take refuge in the experience or the example of, hey, if you meditate, you can suffer less. You take refuge in knowing what reality is, so you don't take it personally. So you actually, you know, are congruent and live congruent with reality. And then you take refuge in other people who are on this journey with you. I mean, you know, if I went to a mountaintop by myself and lit a fire and played drumming, it wouldn't be very fun. I mean, I might have an experience, but the type of rhythmic West African drumming I do, it's a style called Malinke or Manding drumming, which actually is the story of the Lion King, the Mali Empire. It's that rhythmic tradition. This is polyrhythm. This involves at least five or six different instruments being played to produce one rhythm. And the rhythm itself isn't the whole experience. It's we're drumming for dancers, singers, and then, of course, you need to do all of that within a space that is safe and appropriate for that kind of environment. You can't build a 9-foot-tall fire everywhere. You can't make huge amounts of sound with 100 people everywhere. And so we get into this idea of the ordeal. You know, Joseph Campbell would be very proud of me for bringing up this idea that we all go through ordeals, and transformation tends to happen through struggle. And so it's a fairly innocuous struggle to go and exhaust myself dancing all night or drumming all night or whatever it is. But still the ordeal of surmounting exhaustion for 3 nights in a row and greeting the sun and having that experience of deep bone tired body exhaustion and getting out of your head, that is very transformative. I mean, I think we all have experiences. We all have ordeals that we engage in, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes not. And I think that, you know, be it growing up, pulling crawfish out of the water or, doing something that is not safe, you know, that is challenging. I think all of these things shape our brains profoundly. And I would encourage folks to engage with ordeals, find the growth edge, find the place where things are painful, scary, difficult, and do that. You know, I grew up in the water too. I'm a grandson and son of lobstermen and Navy men and things like that. So I was pulling lobster pots as a kid and, you know, doing all things like that. And in spite of that, the ocean still kind of terrifies. And maybe because of that, you know, you realize how powerful and raw and primal the ocean is.
Been in some storms, man, to make you go, well, you know.
Oh my God, yeah.
Lightfoot says it best, when the waves turn the minutes to hours and you're just like, oh my God.
And you know, and you don't know if you're going to make it out of that. You realize just what a profound guest you are in this alien environment to some extent. But you know, my next ordeal, I'm 45, and I've started a few companies recently that are going to take a few years to get up and running. And I'm sort of planning a sabbatical at 50, where I do a circumnavigation on a sailboat. Not because it's the most interesting thing, because I'm not terrified by it, but because I am actually terrified by, you know, being a month away from shore. Over miles of ocean, you know, without any control and having to sort of, to me, that is the next challenge. That is the next primal or, you know, or ordeal, so to speak.
I think ordeal is lightening up what that'll be like. But I mean, it's true. I tell people, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm not going to give direct advice, but sometimes it's good to put yourself in a situation to where you're like fourth on the food chain. I've been in that situation a lot of times in my life, and one very close one I may have said on here before. But anyway, right after that experience, the ideas that were coming through my mind that everyone has to experience this, I went and built a company called Primal Nature. And for like 6 to 8 months, I was taking people on actual primal adventures. No bed and breakfast here, and had a couple people cry a few times wanting to go home.
Sure.
And, you know, and but you witness those rebirths as well. You witness, yeah. You know, that, oh man, that alive feeling people witness, you know. Yep. All right, two-part question here, man. One, I'm still interested in your first ordeal, whatever age that was that made you, you know, grow from that to seek from that. I mean, I know there's something there, and it's been sidestepped 2 or 3 times. I don't know, man. I try to get people to reveal what their ordeal is.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. I think my first ordeal may have been as a little kid. I was one of these kids who was intellectual but slightly awkward and, you know, geeky and didn't have a lot of social skills. And I think my first ordeal was learning to be alive, learning to sort of integrate, you know, the slightly quirky little kid that I was. I mean, I had a vocabulary that was, you know, post-college age in first grade. That doesn't necessarily make you just like every other kid, you know, having a slightly advanced, you know, language ability. And that changed how I viewed the world. You know, I viewed the world sort of with symbols and with language and having to integrate and figure out where I belonged was a big ordeal. I think a lot of, you know, young kids end up having this. Unless you're sort of a typical kid fitting into the culture you were born into, You know, there's an individuation that happens in teen years, certainly, where kids stop being the identity of their parents and their peers and start developing a new identity, first informed by the non-parent peers and then eventually informed, hopefully, by some synthesis of experiences and identity that, you know, the individual comes or arrives at. But for me, it was, you know, I'm not sure if I have any specific ordeal beyond that. I think it was all ordeal up until, you know, maybe I was 25 and I finally integrated some of these lessons that I had been maybe resisting for, you know, the first 20 years or so.
Yeah, sure. I like how you referenced that, man. I think the ordeal is trying to learn ourselves or who we are. I don't even like the phrase who we are because that, for me, concretes kind of a, well, concretes personality. Like, that's who I am. I don't even like that phrase. I say that in the book. And, you know, pushing ourselves into these environments we're uncomfortable, you know, trying to change those. I think we all do. I referenced in an area, I use an example of, you know, take, for example, a kid who's new to an elementary school who is now waiting in the lunch line, who has to come out the other side and find the place to sit down.
Yeah. And
as that kid comes out, he's looking for behaviors, symbols, something that shows friendly. There's fear moving him. And then the first kid that kind of acknowledges some idea of, hey, how you doing? It's there. Next thing you know, that kid may over time change how he talks, how he looks, how he dresses because of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in developmental psychology, there's that sort fear. Of this time around between 12 and 15 where the identity of the individual goes from being largely an extension of parent values to peer values. And this is when the kid comes home wearing leather jackets, when the new piercing and smoking cigarettes, whatever it is, and all the bad habits, quote unquote, of their peers. And parents are horrified that this kid suddenly is an alien, you know, not the little sweet kid that they grew up with, you know, the previous year. But, you know, parents need to know that this is a healthy process. This is an individuation. This is somebody developing an identity that is separate from the sort of birth group, the parent group. Now, it starts off with developing the in-group identity. The kid who's leaving the lunch line is trying to figure out in-group versus out-group. Where do I belong? Who are like me? And this is a healthy thing for, you know, genetic distribution long-term. You know, if you figure out that people who have your similar genetics are like you, then you protect them, you feed them, your genetics get passed on. But this can be sort of bastardized too and used poorly where we develop our artificial boundaries between in-group versus out-group, like, you know, ethnic and racial divides. You know, race is not a very legitimate concept scientifically. You know, the phenotype, what we look like, what some of the surface characteristics genetically are, that's valid. You know, that sorts and resorts across ethnicities and cultures, if you will. But go much deeper than that into the body and the brain, and race breaks down. It is not a valid concept scientifically. It's mostly a cultural concept. And so when the kids live in the lunch line, hopefully the in-group cues are not purely cultural, ethnic cues, because then that just reinforces our sort of, you know, us versus them perspective. I think that the individuation, the cultural identity that we acquire, we have some responsibility to look at where we're being socialized, to look at the big messages that are out there about culture, race, gender, sex, and, you know, use some decision-making process to figure out if we want to adopt these values or not. And as a teenager, that's hard to do, but that's really when it starts to happen. It's when the responsibility of deciding who you are really is.
Yeah, it does come along. And I wish I knew who to quote and give credit to. They were talking about one of the worst things that parents do is enforce their personal beliefs onto their child, which is believe like this. This is religion. This is, you know, I mean, obviously when I try to guide health, you know, suffering, you know, imprisonment, things like that. But the idea of pushing your own beliefs on a child doesn't allow them to kind of prosper into themselves early. You can actually do damage by doing so.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that helping or allowing, providing space for a kid to develop their own identity in all areas, be it spiritual, psychological, social, this is really important. But it also can be somewhat challenging. I mean, I grew up, my parents were, you know, typical sort of New England Protestant type parents, but we did not go to church as a kid. And all my peers did. I mean, I grew up in a heavily Portuguese part of New England, and you know, Portuguese, ethnically, culturally, Portuguese are in this part of the world anyways, very religious, you know, a heavy Roman Catholic part of the world. And all my friends in fifth grade, whenever we're doing catechism class and doing other, I'm not sure what it's called, confirmation and other sort of, you know, strategic ritual state life stages.
Yeah.
And I was sort of pleased I didn't have to go to Sunday school three times a week and study the Bible, but also I didn't have these rites of passage. You know, I mean, I didn't have those things as a young person. I didn't get confirmed. I didn't get acknowledged in a church or a spirituality. And I think for me, that is one of the things that drove me to finding my own spiritual community in my, you know, late teens and 20s, was the fact that I didn't actually have this rigid, my parents had a more rigid, more regular spiritual, if you will, religious upbringing than I did. And it wasn't totally congruent with their identity as an adult. And so they decided not to, you know, indoctrinate us, not to have us go through the same churches that they went to, not to have us baptized. And so I sort of was this, you know, intellectual New Englander without any real embedded spirituality or religion, definitely. And maybe because of that, I had freedoms to synthesize what I needed out of it, but it also had much less structure. And so I ended up finding this really in my early 20s, where many of my peers may have had, you know, a system imposed on them, but it was certainly a structure and a spiritual vocabulary and perspective that they developed, you know, from early years. So I'm not sure one is better than the other. In both cases, people have to come up with their own perspective on what works for them, what they believe, what they think is valid spiritually. I just think that my path worked for me. Other paths might work for other people, so to speak.
Spoken like a true ecstatic practitioner. Okay, nice curve. Those experiences are hard to explain on any level, on any belief level, really. And really, where I start out talking about the book is pulling from some of the cognitive ideas about changing belief, you know, and mm-hmm. getting mm-hmm. down to, you know, our thoughts are created by our beliefs, our thoughts create our feelings, et cetera, you know, the basic cognitive psychology approach.
Sure, sure.
And trying to explain the difference between a thought and a belief that's been reinforced through past experiences and social constructs, et cetera, is where a lot of people do begin to, that cognitive dissonance sets in because the experience was so real, it must be truth, it must be real, and it becomes wordplay to them. And,
yeah.
You know, for your definition, how do you see or what is a belief?
Well, I think beliefs to some extent are learning. They're ways that we have of interpreting what we are presented with. I mean, the brain largely is a pattern extraction machine. It's one of the things that our brain does so well. It's why we are incredibly sophisticated creatures on this planet. We are really good at extracting patterns and then learning from them. We're also good at extracting patterns where they don't exist. Pigeons, for instance, are superstitious. If you teach a pigeon that if it pecks a bar and it gets a pellet of food or something, sometimes a pigeon will, you know, turn around three times just spontaneously as it goes to peck the food the first time, and it goes, whoa, I got food. And it learns it must, you know, turn around three times before it gets its food. Scientists didn't teach it that, you know, in the Skinner box, but pigeons will develop really bizarre stylized behavior if they happen to get rewarded spontaneously. Occasionally learning will happen. And so now they have a belief they must hop on one foot and coo three times and then peck the bar to get the food. That's, you know, that's not necessarily valid.
I'm laughing, you know, man, because all of my years playing sports.
Exactly. Baseball players will, you know, tug the brim, spit left, spit right, tap the bat, tap their foot. You know, there's a reason for that. It looks a little silly to the non-baseball players to go, what is that guy doing?
Yeah.
But it has been reinforced. Our brains go, oh, the pattern of hitting a home run involves pulling my brim down and tapping my left foot three times. We, as, you know, mammals that have these funky brains, we look for patterns. And we will grab patterns and believe patterns that may have nothing to do with reality, but are not incongruent with reality. The pigeon still gets its food if it hops on its foot three times and then pecks the bar. And so it learns that, oh, the hopping on its foot three times is the necessary thing. So that's the challenge, I think, as intellectual creatures, is noticing the automatic behavior and starting to maybe determine you know, where we are acting with automaticity, with, you know, momentum, and evaluating, is this really necessary? Is this really real? Including examining our beliefs and our belief systems to figure out if they're serving us in all the ways that we need them to.
Yeah. And so your research kind of goes beyond that psychology, that cognitive approach, and also, you know, the behavioral approach that I like as well, the structured approach, and going down into the brain's functioning part of all of that, kind of trying to decipher what's what. And I know you do a lot of brain mapping. If you would kind of explain basic brain mapping for those listening, and then I'll get a little farther into it if you could.
Yeah, sure. So brain mapping, what I do, that's a form of neuroimaging we call QEEG or quantitative EEG. And this is looking at the baseline patterns of your brain. You know, when the brain is sitting and resting, it's actually fairly active. And believe it or not, the brain is more metabolically active when you aren't thinking, just kind of drifting and daydreaming, than when you are concentrating. When you concentrate and think furiously and focus, a lot of nodes shut down in the brain. The brain is less active metabolically when you're concentrating versus when you're kind of drifting. This is sort of what we look at in brain activity. We look at EEG or bands or frequency ranges, things called delta, alpha, beta, gamma, etc. These are brain waves or oscillations per second, little firing. We have little CPUs, a couple billion little CPUs that fire at certain rates, and their firing rates combine with other little CPUs to make circuits temporarily and do things, and then recombine with other circuits. And in a QEEG, we look at the resting baseline brain activity. We have you close your eyes with a full head of EEG on your head for, you know, a few minutes. Have you open your eyes for a few minutes. Take those two baseline brain map or brain readings and compare them to a normative database that has several thousand brains in it. Out of that, we get maps about how unusual your brain is from a background population. Now, just because your brain's different doesn't mean something's wrong. And so the QEEG process, we then have to figure out, of the most statistically unusual things I'm seeing, are some of these things, you know, getting in the way? Are they true for you? You know, if I see a marker of excess frontal theta, that's often congruent with impulsivity. And so if the person's impulsive, then we go, oh yeah, that excess theta is driving impulsivity. We have a signature, a physiology marker for it, and we can start to manipulate it and work on it. But there's a lot of, you know, a lot of intra-individual variability. So what's a problem for one person might just be a normal variant or a resource for somebody else. And so with QEEG, we tend to use what's called standard deviations or Z-scores. And we pick an arbitrary line and say, you know, if you're above about 1.5 standard deviations from typical, this is probably an unusual pattern. It might be getting in the way or something you actually are aware of. And so the joke I tell is that the brain mapping process is more prognostic than diagnostic. I'm guessing about what might be true. And then the person's experience is really what we believe in terms of trying to understand the person. I say, yeah, you know, I'm thinking that this, this, and this are happening for you. Oh, they are. Great. Then we should believe the data. And we figure out, you know, it's sort of somewhere between an art and a science as I'm interpreting brain activity statistically unusual against the population. But then we got to really ground it in what the person is experiencing, which is sometimes the challenge in brain mapping. So
I like that you say that, because in counseling and psychology, for me, I've always called it an art form based on a little bit of science. And I've had professors and people get so mad at me, and I'm going, look, it's an art form. You told me 90% of this is who I am as a person. 10% is the books. But then when I tell you it's an art form, you tell me it's, and so right. I go like, look, this is application, you know, mixed with, you know, art. And so the science part, you also said something else I loved, which is probably going to spark a cognitive rampage in you or me. You know, when even Dr. Carl Hart pointed out that idea when they showed the brain imaging on methamphetamine, not on meth, and that standard deviation didn't mean anything. That this is the brain on meth, this is the brain off meth, and it's supposed to look all scary. And technically, in a room, there'd be such a standard deviation, it would all kind of look up in the air. And when you said that, that we vary so much that it may or may not in the art form, how do you see the definition of addiction as being a brain disease?
Yeah, I mean, I think addiction, if you drop back to the sort of pure definition in psychology of addiction, has two components. One is tolerance and the other one is dependence. That really just talks about the physiology of addiction. The psychology of addiction is much more nuanced. And I think that addiction as a disease is a pretty hot button topic. And there's some evidence that some brains are more predisposed for learning with certain substances. You know, there's an opioid receptor in the brain, and we have variants of it, different types of it. And some people have a type of opioid receptor that is extra rewarded by alcohol. They find alcohol extra yummy. Does that mean that they have an addiction disease? Not necessarily, but it means they might get in trouble with alcohol faster or develop a behavioral problem or a lifestyle problem with alcohol faster. So I'll sidestep the addiction as a disease question because I'm not sure it's the right question. I think that with substances, it becomes much more about your relationship with the substance and much less about the substance. Even methamphetamine. Methamphetamine is a fairly similar molecule to Adderall, to dextroamphetamine, other amphetamines. Very similar molecule. And if you give somebody small amounts of Adderall or small amounts of methamphetamine, it completely masks the brain activity patterns we see that are related to ADHD. It's basically a poor theta-beta ratio is ADHD, impulsivity, executive function. It's a really well-validated marker. In QEG mapping, I could take blind data from thousands of people and sort you into ADHD and non-ADHD piles using one measure of electricity. Simply the ratio, ratio theta to beta at the vertex of the head. Vince Monastra did a lot of good research on this historically that shows that it's something like 96% accurate. Blindly sorting ADHD and non-ADHD with one metric. A measure of theta to beta on the vertex of the head. And yet, you give somebody 5 milligrams of Adderall or a little bit of methamphetamine, and you completely don't see those patterns. I'm not sure that that says anything about meth versus Adderall. What it says is that things we put in our bodies change our minds. And it doesn't have to be meth or Adderall or caffeine. It can be, high-fat diet versus high-carb diet. Profoundly different effects on the brain. It can be getting hydrated versus not. It can be having a really rich, nutritionally complete diet versus eating, Twinkies and chips all day. Those things are as problematic as a drug addiction, quote unquote, habit, potentially. I mean, some drugs are also different. If you get seriously addicted to alcohol, there's a profound physiologic tolerance to alcohol. If you suddenly withdraw profound alcohol addiction, you may have a stroke or a heart attack because the physiology is so tolerant. In alcohol, the brain gets tolerant to the GABA release that alcohol causes, the alpha wave release. And after years of chronic binge drinking, your brain has stopped producing GABA because the alcohol does it for you. And then this is why the chronic alcoholics are shaky and nervous and can't calm down and can't fall asleep. It's because the brain has become educated that it does not need to make these slow brain waves because alcohol is on board and doing it for the brain. So I'm trying to emphasize or underscore this idea that it's about the relationship you develop with the substance. It's not about, oh my God, you're doing this weird drug, because you can get in trouble with non-drugs too. You can have problematic relationships with video games or television or food or sex.
Work.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter so much what we're talking about. It's about the relationship you have with these things. Why are you doing it? Why are you eating a pint of ice cream? Why are you sparking up the joint? If it's recreational, if it's low key, if it's enjoyable, if it's moderate, great. If it's, oh my God, I'm so stressed out, I need to drink this alcohol, I need to smoke the joint, I need to, do the opiate, then we have a problem. If it's reactivity, if it's a maladaptive coping strategy, and if you're receiving consequence, if your behavior is so dysregulated that your engagement with the substance is dysregulating other aspects of your life, that's when things are problematic. That's when you really need to look at what you're doing. And again, look at the momentum. Look at why you're doing these things and add some intention back in. Because, we react quite frequently all day long to things we're experiencing. And if your reactions involve reaching for alcohol, cannabis, heroin, Xanax, sleeping pills, doesn't really matter what it is. If it's reaction instead of action, then I think it's a very slippery slope and you may find yourself in involuntary almost behavior, automatic behavior, and that's when things get troubling, I would say.
Yeah, I'm I apologize for the loaded question of addiction. And truthfully, I was going to make a statement, and then I said, let me shape it to a question midair. And, and the truth is, what I wanted to say is, this is why it's detrimental to enforce to people in our current treatment today that they have a brain disease, because people adapt that to unchangeable, static functioning. Nothing can move what I do. This is just me for life. And
yeah, and we shouldn't say that. I mean, nothing about the brain is permanent. Nothing. The brain changes. That's its whole damn job is to change. If I sent you to play, you know, to do a brand new, let's say I sent you to do a piano lesson today for an hour, assuming you don't already play piano, 1 hour of piano lesson, by the end of the day today, every single cell in the hand area, every single neuron would have remapped its connections and moved around. Within hours, within minutes, it starts happening. So the brain learns. Shift happens. It's not a question of how, of if shift is going to happen. It's a question of how. And knowing that the brain is always changing, always reacting, always patterning itself against the challenges we're experiencing, the stimuli we're exposed to. I mean, it's trying to minimize pains and maximize gains. And that's why things like sugar and sex are so rewarding, because they're gains. In an environment 20,000 years ago, we had low access to free sugar, maybe low access to free mates. Those things were incredibly rewarding, sugar and sex. Nowadays, we have more access, let's say, to those things. We have too much access to sugars, and they become problematic. We get dysregulated in our behavioral management of those things. But I think that's just, you know, part and parcel of being human is walking that middle path between, you know, engaging with things you enjoy, but not having them control you. You know, have your thoughts. Don't have your thoughts control you. So.
Yeah, and we do that a lot with behavior change. You know what I love, man? You just, I sat back and smiled because I went, there's the cognitive rampage. There it is.
That's right.
There it is. The brain's static. It doesn't change. Now I know the trigger words.
Yeah, man. Shift happens. The brain's always changing. It absolutely is changing. So it's not a question of if it's going to change, it's how, and you have some control over that. That's actually my sort of mission, is to remind people, to encourage people to remember your brain is changing. It is changing right now. It will change tonight. It will change tomorrow. So would you like to have some control? Would you like to steer that direction of change? Or will you just be reactive? You know, there's an opportunity for intention, an opportunity for steering the direction of change. And skills and techniques like mindfulness meditation, like high fat, low carb diets, like neurofeedback, like nootropics, like ecstatic techniques, these things all change the trajectories of our brain development and our psychological resources. And so don't be satisfied. Don't be satisfied with depression, anxiety, trauma, seizures, migraines. If your brain is not behaving the way you want it to, vast list of things you can engage with to quickly change your function. The brain changes more quickly than the mind. You might do therapy for years to get rid of a trauma. You can change the brain's reaction to the trauma in days or weeks with certain types of neurofeedback, medication. So you should never be satisfied if your brain isn't doing what you want. You know, if your body isn't doing what you want, go to the gym. If your brain isn't doing what you want, engage with similar analogous things like mindfulness meditation, neurofeedback, biohacking in terms of diet, sleep, exercise. Your brain will change very rapidly and faster than your body changes. So that's the good news.
Now that is a cognitive rampage for sure, man.
That's right.
I mean, while I got you on this flow state there, you know, you talked some about some of the issues with the DSM. I have a ton of issues with the DSM myself.
Yeah.
And how they come to finding diagnosis of people. Can you kind of walk through your ideas or issues? I don't want to pigeonhole you, but maybe to some topic where it applies.
Yeah. So the DSM, of course, initially was a tool for insurance companies, a tool to code symptoms so you knew what to pay out on. That's really what it was. It's just like, I sort of think of the DSM as analogous to the BMI, the body mass index. The BMI is a tool for actuarials. It is not a tool for doctors. It is used by doctors because they think that, you know, oh, okay, you have a BMI that's too high, therefore there's increased risk of heart disease, whatever. But the BMI breaks down if you look at individuals. At a population level, it works. You know, if you, on average across many, many people. But there are people who are outliers on a bell curve who are still normal. You know, unusual is normal. And when we talk about the brain, it's almost all unusual. So I would say that a lot of variability is really typical. The DSM, as a symptom classification for insurance companies, was okay. But unfortunately, it didn't talk about causes, mechanisms, or even really ways of handling what you're dealing with. The most recent DSM, the DSM-5, was an attempt to start to figure out the causes and the operational sort of signatures of many diseases and stop being simply a symptom checklist. But of course, we have some bureaucracy and, you know, we are a complicated, you know, thinker society. And the DSM-5, when it finally came out, was imperfect and didn't really, you know, meet its goals of actually describing disease. It still does describe symptom checklists to some extent. And unfortunately, it got rid of some diagnoses that we know to be somewhat relevant. Like, there's no longer a diagnosis for Asperger's in the DSM-5. But there is a form of autism that has no intellectual deficit and has slightly quirky social skills and obsessive interests in topics and maybe bizarre personal hygiene and maybe you love Star Trek or the Civil War or something. That's a real thing. You know, there is a brain type in this high-functioning sort of autism world. And yet nowadays, insurance companies, if you're using the DSM-5, will not accept the diagnosis of Asperger's. This is a failure of the DSM. This is a failure of modern medicine in terms of how we classify treatments. And I think that we are still pretty far away from understanding the brain in terms of psychology. I really hope that in 3 or 4 more revisions of the DSM, we have things where it's like the ADHD diagnosis includes a theta-beta ratio. If the theta-beta ratio can sort ADHD and non-ADHD populations well above 90%, that's a better diagnostic criteria than a psychologist doing an interview. And therefore, the DSM criteria for ADHD should really include a theta-beta ratio as a physiologic marker, you know? And there's lots of things like that where you can sort of see fairly robust markers that are, you know, not necessary, but if they show up, you would assume there is a significant likelihood of that disorder, that challenge. And from a neuroimaging point of view, we can actually find discriminants or biomarkers for many of these categories of psychological dysfunction or challenge in the brain. And I think that's the piece the DSM has yet to really bring in, is the brain, is the neuroscience piece of it. And so over the next few iterations, I hope they finally get rid of the insurance company-driven classification of disorder perspective, add in more causal stuff, more ideology, and start bringing in the physiology. You know, if somebody has reverse frontal lobe activation, the chance of them being depressed, having major depression, are very great. If somebody closes their eyes and the visual cortex doesn't calm down, it stays in active beta, that's hypervigilance. It's a very robust marker for hypervigilence. That's an anxiety marker, you know? Exactly. If somebody has an overactive anterior cingulate and posterior cingulate, they might have PTSD. And, you know, when you can look at the brain and say fairly robust things about psychology, I think the fact that we ignore this in lieu of a symptom checklist that is imperfect and driven by a population perspective instead of an individual's real needs. I think we're doing individuals disservice by classifying things at a population level. So there's my rant.
That is a better answer than I've ever done about it, man. I mean, that we truly are. We say that therapy and the therapeutic approach is to the individual, but then yet we classify people away from the individual into perfect little things we can put on the shelf.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have two parts here, but the first one is, I'll just ask, is it may be long. And then second part is a little more personal, but, not that the two are connected. It's going to seem like it, but, do you see any standout markers brain wise for bipolar diagnosis?
You know, I don't. Bipolar is a very complicated brain pattern. And I will say one thing about quantitative EEG as a neuroimaging technology. It is a 10,000-foot view of the brain. It is showing me traits, not states. It is not deterministic. Okay. And so I might see some anxiety markers or some instability markers or connectivity markers. Now, that might show up as bipolar disease. It might show up as some schizoaffective problem, might show up as some anxiety. I can't necessarily finally say, oh, you have this kind of brain. And the biomarkers we see in qEEG, some of them are more deterministic. If you have a theta-beta ratio of 3, let's say, or above, you probably are ADHD, and I would be very, very surprised if you aren't. But there's no real discriminant of bipolar disorder that way.
Yeah.
You know, there are some discriminants that are likely to show up if you're depressed, but you can be depressed without the marker. You can be depressed without showing the physiology markers. So they are imperfect. They are a 10,000-foot view. And so this is where the clinical sort of art comes in, is knowing that brains are individual, that there is a tendency for symptoms to cohere around certain brain patterns, but you don't want to believe the data. You want to believe the individual.
Yeah, that's my issue with that bipolar diagnosis, is that it becomes a diagnosis based on those criterion that you mentioned that insurance companies are requiring. Yeah. And again, we get into the art form of 2 weeks to 6 months for experiences. And I mean, the doctor's asking you, it might as well be a pharmaceutical commercial. So, I mean, yes, I have that. Yeah, I was depressed as a kid. Yeah, it was longer than 2 weeks. I mean, you know, this diagnosis becomes so up in the air. And not only is ADHD, but bipolar in dual diagnosis facilities has skyrocketed as the, you know, top diagnosis. And I had a very esteemed psychiatrist actually tell me that, Adam, we were working at a place, and he said, look, if all the people that are currently in here that are diagnosed with bipolar were real, then we would have almost the population of the state of Florida of bipolar people in the room at once. And that put perspective on me, because we were just one hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's, I think they become sort of, you know, diagnoses of a fashion to some extent. You know, the amount of Ritalin and Adderall being prescribed in elementary schools now is ridiculous. And there's no chance that, you know, 60, 70% of kids in some schools have ADHD. In fact, I think we're getting into a topic where it's important to not pathologize variability. I think ADHD is sometimes a disorder when it's profound, it's getting in the way of your life. In other times, it's necessary and essential. We had this evolutionary reasons why it's important to have people who can notice everything in the environment and process things, but not be as heads down or as sustained in their attention. And it's also important to have people who can be sustained in their attention. You know, I'm one of those distractible hunter types. We also need gatherers. We also need folks who can weed the plants and sit and carve the amazing artwork for 20 hours straight. That's not my brain. I like the high stimulus, high information, you know, switching gears things much more. That's where my skills are. And so I think we pathologize individuality, unfortunately, and then we medicate it. And that is true in both, you know, kids with ADHD as well as in inpatient environments with dual diagnosis. Yes, of course you're oppressed if you've dysregulated your life so profoundly you ended up inpatient. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have, quote unquote, major depression or bipolar depression. It just might mean that in the moment your brain is dysregulated. And I think we need to separate the sort of labeling of the individual with labeling of the moment.
You're speaking to our terrible, terrible robot creating education system that our children have to fit into. Otherwise, they're labeled as these ideas. And my other issue are the learning styles that they teach. I'm co-authoring a book with Dr. Bobby Hoffman, who wrote a book on learning for performance and motivation. And we're kind of chopping his book up, but he talks about how learning styles, these children are labeled by teachers with basic unprovable and research tests that this child is visual, this child is audio. And he explains that this is bullshit. He's like, no, we're all so complicated and mixed up that this isn't even so. And it becomes, and he says, this becomes detrimental to children because they grow up then going, well, I'm a visual learner, and they don't apply themselves at difficult learning situations, which obviously I'm learning now helps the brain grow and develop.
Yeah, challenge is definitely necessary so we can stretch ourselves and not be sort of stuck into one set of challenges. Absolutely. Yeah.
The second part, I got a little ADHD too. The second part of that bipolar initiation question was also links to the education idea, the labeling, the influx, the 60% influx type generally we referenced of ADHD diagnosis in kids, and the severity levels that the DSM-5 tried to bring in. Now, myself have been diagnosed with ADHD, I purposely set out in about a 6-month period to see 5 different psychiatrists and tried to keep my responses. I just stayed honest. And in the moment, I spread it out over 6 months to try to let every situation in life, you know, hit me at certain times. And obviously their criteria is 2 weeks to 6 months. And anyway, I wanted to see what the process was like, what the diagnosis would come back as. And out of the 5, 2 diagnosed me as bipolar. 1 diagnosed me as nothing is wrong with you until you ingest coffee and then not like you have done the 3 times to see me. And he diagnosed me with substance-induced hypomania. And
oh, interesting.
And the mass of them said ADHD and, like I said, the 2 bipolar. And then the one guy who was basically saying, he said, look, you're just chemically induced hypomania. And he goes,
interesting.
And I said, so let me walk down this idea. And he explained this to me. He goes, Adam, the issue that we're finding is that, say, somebody like yourself that's on an ADHD lower in severity level, you know, moderate to low, you're in there depending on a situation and time, et cetera. But you're enough to pass high school, get through college when you apply yourself with a lot of caffeine-focused drug. And then as life starts to kind of get more difficult in the separation where it requires focus, staying in a long career, staying in something, relationships even, it goes, this becomes maladaptive for you. And then over time, why wouldn't you be anxious and depressed at times in your life that go up and down?
And he absolutely.
Goes, yeah. So then he goes, this is why I'm telling you the other 2 psychiatrists misdiagnosed you as bipolar, because I think you were probably a low-end moderate ADHD. I was also involved in a lot of trauma as a kid. And through that trauma, but this ADHD, it went unnoticed. And so now as you get older, and I started putting 2 and 2 together, how many people are a low-end moderate ADHD, which could be a natural evolution of this time frame in human anyway, and then it's missed, and then they can't focus, and then later in life they're just depressed and have used drugs or self-sabotaged, and then they get hit with bipolar, and they're stuck on medication for the rest of their life.
Yeah, and I think it's this rush to label, this rush to diagnose, because, again, to a man with a hammer, every problem is a nail. To the psychiatrist, the nail is the prescription pad. When somebody comes in with a set of symptoms, the goal is to try to figure out which of the things they already know about are showing up. Not necessarily to, the perspective should be to help the individual move their function to a different level. But the default is often those 5 minutes you sit with a psychiatrist, they're just trying to get the right answer. And they think they know of the 4 answers they want to give you, which one it is. I think that the DSM is doing us disservice that way because psychiatrists don't get paid unless they classify you. And therefore, it encourages them to fit you into one of the boxes that they have, you know, to file you into. So,
yeah, that convenience organization of what you are and who we are, so our pill concoctions can hopefully work for you.
And they work imperfectly as well, which is another rant here. Is I think that, you know, 70, 80, 90% of psychiatric medications are unnecessary when you have tools like mindfulness meditation, neurofeedback, and biohacking with diet. We can ameliorate much of what we consider psychological problems by retuning the brain and doing non-drug things to actually shift function. You know, we can eliminate ADHD 90% of the time with neurofeedback in a few months. Eliminate it permanently. Gone.
Yeah, not treat people. Not treat.
Not treat it. Cure. Eliminate it. I mean, I can say the word cure because I'm not a psychologist. I'm a neuroscientist. Psychologists can't say the word cure. It's a big no-no. But I can get rid of ADHD. I can get rid of sleep problems 9 times out of 10. I can get rid of anxiety. I can get rid of PTSD. I can reduce the incidence of seizures. I can reduce the incidence of migraines. I can eliminate or reduce traumatic head injury markers. All of this happens fast in weeks or months. Now, we've been told that your depression, your ADHD, your anxiety, your sleep issue are a permanent issue for your brain. That's what I fight against, is this idea that the brain is this mysterious, you know, thing we can't change. No, yes, it's mysterious, but we can absolutely change it, and we should be changing it. We should be taking control of it. So I want to leave folks with that perspective, that shift happens, and do not be satisfied with your brain, your body, your mind, if it's not sort of doing what you want it to do.
Yeah, man, I get a lot of feedback when I say that general physicians that are prescribing antidepressants are practicing outside of their scope.
Yeah, often. So.
Yeah, they are, man. I mean, we covered a lot of stuff. We really didn't get to the sounded like you had to run, man. So
I do actually, unfortunately.
All right. Yeah, no worries. And you know what? Maybe we come back in a month or so or two, maybe. I'd like to get into the alternative treatment stuff.
Sure, sure. Yeah, nootropics, neurofeedback, all sorts of things we can talk about if you want.
Yeah, well, neurotropics was next. And then we were going to head down to alternative treatments too. Because neurotropics, I had a formulator on last week, 25-year-old whiz kid, man. And he was shallow in neurotropics. He just didn't know, and he said that. So I was going to get there too. But if you'll come back in maybe a month, two, when we can, and finish this up.
Sure, sounds good. Sounds good.
All right, man, where can everybody actually come get cured with you?
Yeah, so easiest place to find me is on Twitter at Andrew Hill PhD. You can also check out my companies, peakbraininstitute.com. Peak Brain is our QEEG, Neurofeedback and Mindfulness Training Center. We have a Peak Brain in Los Angeles. We're opening up one in St. Louis in the next couple of months, and we'll be in Portland, San Diego, and Orange County quickly. So we're gradually spreading throughout the country. But folks are welcome to come to LA if they want to hang out with me and do some brain work, email me with their own brain questions. I love to hear people's individual brain challenges and questions, and pop up on Twitter, maybe shoot me a quick note, let me know what your own unique brain things are. I'd love to hear about it. So,
hey man, I appreciate it. I'm actually going to be out in LA in August seeing a few friends, man. I'll come by and say hey, maybe.
Yeah, come out. We'll do a brain map on you, a QEEG, and see what your brain looks like if you want.
Oh no. I don't know about that, man.
You can think about it.
Okay, man. Well, thanks again, man, for being on the podcast, man. I look forward
to it. Yeah, my pleasure, Adam.
Look forward to chatting again, man. Thank you.
All right, take care. Definitely.
Oh man, I hope everybody enjoyed that and enjoyed chatting with him. You can always close out, man. You should be able to just it'll shut you out.
All right, Adam. Talk to you later. Take care.
Yeah, brother.
Let me know how the show gets produced, and I'll blast it out to my social media, of course. So.
Oh, yeah, it'll come out. We drop every Monday at 7 a.m. Eastern time, but it's on iTunes, SoundCloud, where you come in and out of the iTunes Top 200. But iTunes, Stitcher for Android, site, SoundCloud, it'll be all over the place.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, brother.
All right, take care. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Okay.
Man, I hope you guys enjoyed just the cusp of that. I wanted to say cusp, just the cusp of that competence. I mean, we were just, grasping the top of it. I look forward to the next month or so when we do line that up to talk to him. But to give you a preface about the alternative treatments that he does, it's quite controversial in a lot of places. And I don't want to butcher it too much. I don't know the laws they've had to adjust to or anything. But, if you reference some, if you look up a guy I reference all the time, a virtual mentor of mine, Dr. Carl Hart, who essentially trains the physicians to talk about this. He's also a neuroscientist, neuropsychologist. But anyway, Dr. Carl Hart, talks about how what most people know as addicts or addiction people suffering from addiction are those that we see on intervention shows, et cetera, the strung out, you touch crack once and life is over, etc. And as Dr. Hill referenced, we see them as diseased people when this isn't so. And, he talks about how that 85% is still functioning in society. Many people in 12-step circles may refer to this as the functioning addict, but I would argue that many of us that are functioning addicts don't realize what we're addicted to. So being a functioning addict has this negative connotation when maybe it shouldn't. But anyway, how 85% still have families, kids, they don't have issues. They don't overdose. They do it healthy. And as he also points out, Dr. Carl Hart, that drugs have this huge negative, unreal connotation about how they destroy your lives at one time, et cetera. It does for that 15% or so. But anyway, what Dr. Andrew Hill does in alternative treatments in California is teach people how to shift from that 15% to the 85%. kind of a new type of no harm treatment rather than just replacing with Suboxone, et cetera, and copping out to, I have a disease, this is my life. Obviously, you know his view now on it. And you can also look up Dr. Carl Hart's arguments on the disease model approach as well. These are two very smart men that do this for a living. Not me saying it, I'm just a guy. But anyway, alternative addiction treatments, what they do out there is teach people that, how to moderately use, how to control their life, how to control the use, how to stay healthy while doing so. And then they mix the brain mapping and the biofeedback that he explained, and people can see dramatic changes quickly, not 30, 90, 60 days of abstinence. Look, I remind you, they tried to teach you abstinence in school, and look how well that did. Okay? So we can keep selling the bullshit propaganda with the war on drugs. The drugs will kill you the minute you touch crack, your life is over, and all this other bullshit. But we'll pump ADHD Adderall medication that is very similar molecule setup to methamphetamine, parents out there. So think about that. Yeah. So we'll cover alternative treatments. He also has a neurotropic that's called True Brain. I was taking Alpha Brain for a little bit. I've discontinued that. But anyway, I wanted to learn more about it. Drew Peters chose to stay in his lane on the last podcast with nootropics. But I know, I'm pretty sure Dr. Andrew Hill will not. But anyway, True Brain is that neurotropic that he's involved with. If you want to prep up for whenever we have our next show, I'd suggest looking up nootropics and alternative addiction treatments. Look up some of that research, et cetera. If you have any questions for Dr. Andrew Hill about anything we talked about today, any DSM questions, cognitive neuroscience, brain mapping, any of that stuff, please find him at the Peak Brain Institute. And if you have any questions you want to ask him on the podcast, also email those to me at cognitiverampagepodcast@gmail.com, and I'll see if I can get those questions in there for you. But anyway, for all of you that are still purchasing the book, reviewing the book, and sending me nice things about it, thank you so much. I meant it when I wrote that there at the end of the book, my little note from me, that I love you. And I think we should say that more to one another in this world. I really do. We maybe hoard that word so much out of fear and past history, but I don't know. Try it. Try just telling people I love you randomly when you get off the phone, etc. And shake them up a little bit, right? But anyway, you can get the book at Amazon.com, The Cognitive Rampage, A Dose of Authentic Revelation. And Amazon, there's a Kindle version as well that's available. And a few things, actually, to add. I forgot. On June 18th in Orlando, Florida, more than likely at the Fusion XL Performance Facility in Ocoee, Florida. Maybe or maybe not. It may be at my new office as well, which is opening in Winter Garden, Florida. But that's up in the air. That's about 80%. But anyway, the workshop, the first Cognitive Rampage workshop, is a go on 6/18. Like I said, maybe here at Fusion. But anyway, it's open to the public. We have two major announcements. We'll be launching something that I wish I could tell you about now, but I can't. We'll be launching something at 6/18 that doesn't exist. It's awesome. And I think it's a way that we can help a lot of people. But anyway, it's 6/18 on Saturday in June from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. It's a rapid fire where I have 10 Tribe of Change speakers. These are guests that have been on the podcast as well as a Secret 7 guest. It'll be 10 speakers that get 10 minutes each to fire out their best on what change is to them. Their cognitive rampage delivered fast. So no long, drawn-out speeches, just a direct, rapid-fire delivery. And we're going to break those speeches up with some music, with some activities, with some hopefully MMA demonstrations and some other fun stuff. But there will be an organic shake bar, I like to say, which is just open for you to make the kind of shake and blend it up and hang out. It's only 2 hours, but it'll be a fun, intense, competence-filling, passion-creating time. And social connection, that's the best part, about being around some people that are looking for the same things in life that you are. You know, looking to optimize, looking to live that cognitive rampage, man. So that's what it's all about. Like I said, it's open to the public. We're launching something that night. If you haven't heard, I hope you're tuning in. For the last month, I have been hosting Fit Project Radio for ESPN here in Orlando. and that's Orlando 580. That's Sundays at 9 a.m. Our next show coming up will be May 29th. That's birthday to myself. Happy birthday, May 29th. But that show will air on Sunday, and Drew Peters is our guest there, like you just heard on the podcast last week, but a much more narrowed 30-minute version of something different, though. It's a totally new interview. But that's coming up on ESPN. Shout out to everybody that listens, that shares, that likes, everyone that's living your cognitive rampage. Reach out to me. Say hello. Tell me how the book is. Tell me how terrible it is. Tell me how much you love it. Tell me how much you hate it. It doesn't matter. But reach out. Say hello. I like connecting with people. And give me a couple days if you reach out on social media, all right? So that's the biggest events that are coming up, I think, so far. New office opening, Cognitive Rampage Workshop on June 18th. That's it, fellas. I love you. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. Bye.